Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
By rocket to the moon, by airplane to the rocket, by taxi to the airport, by front door to the taxi, by throwing back the blanket hanging down the leg.
Okay.
So we want to start off this episode with something we haven't done in a while. And by that, I mean some listener mail. This listener mail comes from Megan, and Megan says, "Hi guys, I love your podcasts. I rely on them as a form of continuing education as I work on my own research and writing projects that relate to technology. As the date approaches for the launch of the final space shuttle, I wondered if you would consider doing one, or a dozen, special episodes on space technology. One episode just on the space shuttle itself would be nice. How does it fly? What does it do? How does it deliver its payloads into space without losing its air pressure?" And then I snipped a big part of her email because it relates to other possible topics we may talk about in the future. And then I go to thanks and keep up the good work, Megan. So yeah, I had to keep that last little bit in.
Yeah, but it's good. You know, want to be inclusive.
Yes. And Megan did have several other suggestions, all of which are wonderful ones. And we will probably get to them in the future. But we want to concentrate on the space shuttle right now.
Yeah, talking about trying to get us to talk about space technology doesn't require a lot of arm twisting. So.
No, we just have to say Gemini.
Yeah, yeah, we've already talked about some in the past, some of the older space tech, but yeah, I think there are several in the future. Let's just say that.
Yeah. And I should also add that we have a great article on HowStuffWorks.com about the space shuttle, and it's called, and brace yourselves, How the Space Shuttle Works. And it's really, really well done. It's a comprehensive, very long, very involved article. Lots of really great animations and illustrations in there. I do highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. I would call it one of our classic How Stuff Works articles.
Yeah.
Because it kind of pulls out all the stops. So we're going to kind of talk about the space shuttle. And I thought we'd start with maybe sort of a brief overview of the history of the program.
Okay, sure.
So you got NASA. You know, they've had their successful launches of getting astronauts into orbit, getting astronauts all the way to the moon and back safely.
Right.
They've made some phenomenal contributions to science. And around 1972, President Nixon announced that what he wanted to see, what the next step in the space program was going to be, was to create a reusable space a shuttle or space transportation system, STS, so that we could actually keep using the same vehicle over and over again. Because prior to that point, the vehicles we'd been using, the capsules we'd been using, were all one use. You used them one time, and that was all you could use them for.
Well, you know, that's one of the benefits. You know, they're disposable. You can pick one up anytime you're out on the road.
Right, you're right. You just go to your Costco and, hey, you know, if I buy them in bulk. No, no, that's not how that worked at all. It was incredibly expensive to develop the capsules, and you could only use them one time. So This was an idea of creating a space program that would use the same vehicle over and over, but there were some trade-offs that you had to make for that. One of those trade-offs was that you couldn't necessarily create a vehicle that could go into high orbits or to travel to distant locations like the moon or Mars. You could only kind of launch into a low orbit. Part of that was this idea of a space shuttle design that could return by gliding down to the Earth's surface, as opposed to, you know, plummeting and then launching out a parachute and then kind of drifting down into the ocean for retrieval. So the design meant that they had to reconcile the fact that we would not be using this same sort of vehicle to go to places like the moon or Mars.
Right, right.
So this was a calculated decision on NASA's part to kind of change the focus of the space program. It was now no longer just – well, it was never just about being the first to the moon, but that was a big part of it, right? The space race was in part – A competition.
Yeah, that's true. The USSR, Soviet Union, was, of course, and this won't be a surprise to probably anybody who listens to this podcast. But yeah, we've talked about the space race before between the United States and the USSR, and you know, it escalated from the time of Sputnik, you know, the ball that beeps, up to the point where they decided they wanted to go to the moon, and it was a competition to see who could go and set foot on the moon first. And, you know, it went from, you know, who can orbit the moon or orbit the Earth first, and then, you know, who can have, you know, set foot on the moon. And then this presented greater challenges because the science involved, the idea of doing science in space, is very compelling.
Yeah.
Because there are things that you can do in outer space that you can't do within the Earth's gravity.
Like lots of flippies.
Well, yeah, that too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is the
also, from what I understand, Tang tastes best if you're in a low Earth orbit.
And yes, contrary to popular myth, Tang was not created for the space program.
It
just happens to be very handy in this context.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, this was when we're talking about this as the early 70s, it's fresh on the heels of you know, the Apollo program.
Yes.
So this is really the next step.
Exactly. And so NASA then awarded the prime contract for the shuttle to Rockwell International.
Mm-hmm.
And Rockwell International had to come up with different ways of creating some reusable materials, including things like the tiles that help absorb heat upon reentry. That was a big thing, right? You know, it wasn't just that that it needed to be able to fly to the surface of the Earth safely, but it had to have something that would absorb and redistribute heat in a way that would protect the people inside and could be used over and over again, as opposed to something that could only do it the one time.
Right. If you go see one of the capsules from the earlier space missions in, say, the Smithsonian Institution, for example, and you actually look at the heat shield on the bottom of the capsule and how burned it looks from reentry, it creates an impression because that's it's an awful lot of friction coming back home.
Ooh, you said the word friction.
I did.
Yeah, let's We'll address that when we get into reentry. But before you guys write in about friction, I want to let you know, I will address that. But you're going to have to wait.
Should we take that
no,
out?
No, no. We need to keep that in because okay. It's important. It's important.
Okay.
Because it's sort of shorthand, right, for talking about the heat that's generated. But it's a little more complicated than that. And don't worry, people. We will talk about it. We're just going to talk about that when we talk about the shuttle re-entering the Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah.
So the first shuttle that was ever built, you know the name of the very first shuttle ever built that was not designed to go into space. It was just the first one that was built to test the flying capability, right?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, I have some history on each of the spacecraft involved.
Yeah.
And I remember this because I actually have, I still have it, a lunchbox with this particular spacecraft on it.
What was the name of this one?
From my younger days. And that would be the Enterprise.
Yes.
OV-101.
Yes, this is and you may wonder, is this in reference to the long-loved science fiction series Star Trek? Yes, it is. the shuttle Enterprise, which was not designed to go into space. It was only to test the gliding and flying capabilities of the shuttle to make sure that the design actually worked. That's all it did. So they launched it from a Boeing 747,
mm-hmm.
and it successfully flew and landed safely at the Edwards Air Force Base.
Yes, and it actually rolled out. If you think about it, we were talking about the early 70s. They didn't waste any time. The Enterprise rolled out on September 17th, 1976.
Yeah.
So it didn't take years and years and years to develop. I also want to say, as an aside, I know we've got a lot to cover, but it ended up being sort of a recursive thing since the Enterprise space shuttle was mentioned in Star Trek as being the first Enterprise.
Yeah.
I find that amusing.
It's meta. So there were other – the actual shuttles that were used in space flights were the Columbia, the Discovery, the Atlantis, the Challenger, and then later the Endeavor. Now, the Columbia, Discovery, Atlantis, and Challenger were the original four shuttles.
Yep. The Columbia was rolled out in 79, Challenger in 82, Discovery in 83, Atlantis in 85, and Endeavor in 91.
And the very first space shuttle flight, as in going into low Earth orbit, was in 1981, and it was the Columbia.
Yes.
Now, again, these were all designed to go into low Earth orbit, and I thought it might be interesting to kind of take sort of an audio tour of the shuttle. In other words, we're just going to kind of talk about the different parts of the space shuttle. And this is I kind of took it from pre-launch.
Okay.
So this is the whole kit and caboodle, one might say. It's not just the orbiter. Now, that's what most of us think about when we think about the space shuttle. You think of the orbiter.
Yeah.
Which is the one that looks kind of like a funky airplane.
Right.
But if you're talking about the whole space shuttle, you're talking about three major sections.
Mm-hmm.
Your solid rocket fuel boosters, which do the lion's share of the work when you're talking about launch. They provide 71% of the thrust that's needed to lift off the launch pad. So you're thinking like, well, if the solid rocket fuel boosters are doing 71% of the work, where's the other 29% coming from? That's actually coming from the orbiter's engines.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get into that. So the solid rocket fuel boosters are use a solid rocket motor. It has a propellant that's it's also got an igniter and a nozzle. So the nozzle, of course, is where it directs the gases out so that it creates thrust.
Mm-hmm.
The fuel it uses consists of the fuel part is the atomized aluminum. It has oxidizers in the form of ammonium percolate. It's got a catalyst in the form of iron oxide powder. It's got a binder agent, which I don't even think I could even pronounce. And then there's a curing agent, which is an epoxy resin. And this material altogether makes a solid rocket fuel. And this stuff weighs a lot. And, you know, it's one of the big challenges with spaceflight is the fact that your fuel weighs so much. In order to launch something of a particular mass into space, you need a lot of fuel to get there. Well, the more fuel you add, the more weight you add. So you have this problem where you've got to get the right ratio of fuel to counteract not just the weight of the vehicle, but the weight of the fuel as
well. Mm-hmm. According to NASA, the space shuttle if you wanted to put it on a scale, you'd need a pretty big scale. It weighs more than 2.04 million kilograms or 4.5 million pounds at launch.
Yeah.
And it uses in 8.5 minutes after launch, it uses more than 1.59 million kilograms or 3.5 million pounds of propellant.
Yeah, it's slightly less fuel efficient than a Hummer.
Yes, but the Hummer doesn't use solid fuel.
No. But I wanted to mention something else. That the solid rocket fuel booster, it's actually jointed. It's not one solid piece. And if you were to ever actually take a look at one of these and just see the scale of it, how huge it is, you would understand. There's no building it out of one piece would not be practical. Well, they use O-rings, rubber O-ring seals, to seal the two sections or the multiple sections together.
Right. Basically, they're sort of like gaskets.
Yes. So these are meant to create an airtight seal around these solid rocket boosters. Well, it was one of these O-rings that caused the problem that led to the Challenger disaster. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the disasters that have happened in the space shuttle program. Well, the Challenger disaster was a very famous one. And what happened was that when the day of that launch, it was unusually cold. The cold weather had made the rubber O-rings shrink a little bit. So they were no longer properly sealing the joints in the solid rocket booster. Mm-hmm. Upon launch, some of the hot gases, I mean, we're talking incredibly hot gases that were being emitted by the solid rocket booster, were escaping through the joints because the O-rings were no longer sealing them properly. Some of these cut through like a blowtorch. They cut through the exterior of the external fuel tank, which is the next section we'll be talking about in a second. Now, the external fuel tank has two different kinds of fuel in it. It has liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen.
Yes.
Well, the hot gases from the solid rocket booster ended up igniting the liquid hydrogen inside the external fuel tank, which then promptly exploded. That was what caused the explosion on the Challenger flight. So it was after that, the space shuttle program actually stopped for a few years after the Challenger disaster while NASA was investigating the disaster and trying to determine what was the cause and how would the organization prevent such a thing from happening in the future. So ultimately, you could say that the rubber O-rings in the solid rocket fuel booster they were to blame for at least that part of the Challenger disaster, the whole initial emergency that then led to the tragedy.
Yeah, and those engines do get hot. They according to NASA, the temperatures inside the engines themselves reach more than 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, around 3,315.6 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, any leak can be catastrophic in a very, very short span of time, as we have seen.
Right. So that's our first section that we wanted to talk about. Next, we have the external fuel tank. Now, this is the big kind of rocket-looking thing that sticks to the shuttle even after they jettison the rocket boosters. By the way, in order to jettison these things, they have these explosive charges between the sections that that when they explode, they break the links between one element and the next.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, that means that you have to also be very careful with that, because I mean, anytime you're using explosives near a whole lot of fuel, clearly you've got to take a lot of precautions. Well, the external fuel tank stores liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, as I said, and that's what provides fuel to the orbiter's three main engines. And it's there's a 6-to-1 ratio for liquid hydrogen to liquid oxygen. So there's mm-hmm. far more liquid hydrogen on than oxygen. The external fuel tank is 158 feet long, which is about 48 meters. And it's got a diameter of 27.6 feet or about 8.4 meters. And when it's empty, it weighs a feather light 78,000 pounds. Or 35,455 kilograms.
Yeah.
And it holds 1.6 million pounds of propellant, which again, 719,000 kilograms. So it's got a total volume of around 526,000 gallons or mm-hmm. 2 million liters. So yeah, it holds a lot of fuel.
Yes, it does.
And it's made out of aluminum and aluminum composite materials. It's got the two tanks. The forward tank is the one for the oxygen. The aft tank is for hydrogen. And then there's an inner tank region that separates the two from each other. So this propellant, it flows through a 17-inch diameter feed line, 43 centimeters. I always have to try to do that because I keep forgetting that we have so many people from around the world who listen to our podcast, and we're used to using these outmoded methods of measurement, and everyone else is much more forward thinking than we are. The fuel flows through this feed line and goes to the shuttle's main engines.
Right.
And then the oxygen, by the way, if you want to know how fast the fuel flows through this line, the oxygen flows through at a rate of around 17,600 gallons per minute. Which is 66,600 liters per minute. Strangely enough, we still use minutes in both systems of measurement. Then hydrogen, though, flows at 47,400 gallons per minute, or 179,000 liters per minute. So quite fast indeed.
Yeah, well, I mean, seriously, you could, if you were using water instead of fuel, the shuttle's engines could drain a regular-sized swimming pool in about 25 seconds.
Yeah, which
according to NASA.
And if you were using water instead of fuel, that would be the most awesome water park ever. Although you could probably only go once. So they burn the fuel in a pre-chamber, mm-hmm. to create the high pressure, and then the heat and the pressure from the gases drive turbo pumps, and then the fuel is burned in the main combustion chamber. They direct the gases out of the nozzle at around 6,000 miles per hour, or 10,000 kilometers per hour. And that means that each of the three engines can generate around 375,000 to 470,000 pounds of thrust. And so that's what's providing that other 29% of thrust when the shuttle is going to launch. The external tank, mm-hmm. is covered with a spray-on foam insulation, which leads us to a brief discussion about the second space shuttle disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Columbia disaster. Now, you may remember when the Columbia was coming in 2003, when it was coming for the descent toward Earth, it broke apart on reentry. Well, the investigation led to the discovery that the likely cause of that was that a piece of this foam insulation broke off of the external tank during launch and struck the orbiter.
Yes.
And that's what weakened the orbiter and caused it to break apart upon reentry.
And one of the most controversial things about the orbiter itself has been the heat resistant tiles.
Yeah.
I mean, even from the very beginning, I remember those discussions when I was a kid. And, they're made of a type of foam, basically, and they're delicate. I mean, even on the very first missions, they would notice that some of them would fall out. And they've done a lot of, made a lot of changes to the tiles over the years, but,
right.
They are still, all things considered, even though they are very heat resistant. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of degrees, because they do, on reentry, hit about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit
as
it comes back into the atmosphere.
It's
or
pretty
about
toasty.
1,648 degrees Celsius. So, I mean, even though they are amazingly heat resistant, they are remarkably fragile for all of that. So
right.
You have to be very careful with that. Now they, on flights subsequent to Columbia's accident, they have been very careful to check the outside of the spacecraft before reentry.
Yeah, and there have been space shuttle launch delays when they've discovered even the smallest of flaws, which, as far as we know, could have potentially have saved the lives of other astronauts.
Yes.
I mean, it's impossible to know, which ones would have successfully landed and which ones wouldn't, but it's much better to know that they've gone through these sort of procedures in order to maintain astronaut safety. I mean, these accidents were tragic in multiple mm-hmm. ways.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, and in my opinion, most importantly, it meant the loss of lives.
Yes.
And that is truly a tragic thing. It also, in a more superficial way, really, when you look at the big picture, meant a setback in the space program, which, you know, that's a problem as well. And we've had a lot of advances in technology due to the space program. So I admire the fact that NASA has taken these incredible precautions, which when you're excited about a launch and you've planned a trip down to Florida to watch a launch, can be frustrating. You know, you go down there and then the launch is delayed because of this, but that's much better than the alternative, obviously. Mm-hmm. So now we're moving on to the orbiter. We talked about the solid fuel rocket boosters and the external tank. The orbiter is next. So the orbiter is, of course, what we think of when we talk about the space shuttle. That's yes. the very iconic shuttle. It has, like I said, three main engines. It's got an orbital maneuvering system. It is each of the orbiter engines, by the way, is 14 feet long or 4.3 meters. And 7.5 feet in diameter, or 2.3 meters. And each engine weighs 6,700 pounds, or around 3,040 kilograms. And it's hard to get a vision on how big that is just when I start saying numbers. If you ever visit one of the centers that has a space shuttle or has one of the engines there, to see it in person is pretty phenomenal. I mean, it's a really... You start to grasp how big the entire vehicle is just by looking at one engine. Mm-hmm. Now, the orbiter consists of there's a forward fuselage, which has the crew compartment inside of it, and it also has the reaction control system module. It's got a movable airlock, which can be used to put inside the crew compartment or inside the cargo bay. Then you've got the mid fuselage. That's where the cargo bay is. That's, you know, the when we think of the doors opening out to space, that's the mid fuselage area. It's where the payload for the space shuttle will be. And payloads could be anything from a satellite that needs to be launched into orbit to pieces of equipment or material for the International Space Station, including supplies for the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. Then you've got, it also has the remote manipulator arm, the robotic arm that we've seen that helps position satellites in the right orientation and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the aft fuselage. So that's the back end of the orbiter. That's where the engines are, the main engines. So the orbital maneuvering system is there. You can think of the orbiter in those three big sections. The one that the astronauts stay in the most is, of course, the forward fuselage. That's where the crew quarters are and the control systems are for the orbiter itself.
Yeah, I mean the crew module is in three sections.
Yes,
where the astronauts will work, live, and stow their gear, and it's got. I was looking something up. Did you get into the where the flight deck and mid deck are?
No.
Okay. Yeah, the flight deck and the mid deck equipment bay and an airlock are the three parts of the crew module. You know, basically, the flight deck is the what you might see in an airplane. If you think about it in those terms, you see where the pilot and the co-pilot are.
Right. And if the shuttle were sitting on the ground, mm-hmm. Horizontal, flat on the ground, the
like
flight
when it
deck,
lands, for example,
right, the flight deck would be the uppermost section of that mm-hmm. of the crew compartment.
Yeah, that's where you'll find the flight controls. It has all the hand controllers, the rudder pedals. There's room for four people on the flight deck. It's got all the everything they need to basically fly, or I guess what do you call it in space? I guess you call it flying it.
Yeah, navigating maybe.
Navigating in space. And if you're looking if you were in the cockpit, you would see the displays and the controls for operating the orbiter itself.
And there are a lot of them.
Yeah. On the right, you would see, the controls for handling payloads. According to NASA, again, more than 2,020 separate displays and controls.
Yeah.
That's what you will find on the flight deck.
And in case you're worried about right versus left, starboard, on the starboard side. Because it all depends on which way you're facing. If you're facing toward the front of the shuttle, it's on the right.
Yeah, that's true.
So starboard side.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that NASA didn't actually use port and starboard in here, but...
Ahoy.
And mid-deck is where you'll find four crew sleep stations.
Yep.
And You also find other types of gear, the waste management system.
Yep, toilet.
The head.
Yeah.
Galley. You call it the head?
The galley.
Personal hygiene station, mm-hmm. and where you would work and eat yep. there. They do fit seven people, up to seven people in a shuttle. The upcoming, actually, as we're recording this, the very last in a 30-year program space shuttle mission is about to launch on July 8th, which is kind of why we are. We actually recorded several episodes before this, but we wanted to get this in before that.
Yeah, yeah. And we shuffled things around.
Yes, we did. And the last crew is actually going to be four people.
Yes.
From what I understand. So they can hold up to seven, but, this last mission will have four.
And the mid-deck also includes exercise equipment, because one of the things we learned in these missions is that if you are in space for any significant amount of time. Now, granted, space shuttle missions last between about 7 and 14 days.
Yes.
Depending on the mission. But you can experience muscle loss and bone density loss. So the exercise equipment is there to help counteract that. It's because, you're in a weightless environment, so you're no longer needing to support your own weight whenever you move around. Everything's much easier. But that means that once you get back down on the ground, where we do have gravity, it becomes a little bit, you may suffer some problems because of muscle loss or bone density loss. So then in the lower deck, that's pretty much where equipment, that's where it quote unquote lives. So life support equipment, electrical systems, that kind of thing. And there are five onboard computers that handle the data processing and the flight systems aboard the shuttle. So those five systems are distributed throughout this area as well. And you've got the two orbital maneuvering systems engines that are located in the aft of the orbiter. These burn monomethyl hydrazine fuel and nitrogen tetroxide oxidizer. I thought I could get through that, and I definitely bungled it. At any rate, this is a different kind of fuel mixture than the external fuel tank, obviously. And also from the solid fuel rocket boosters. And the reason why they're using these two substances together is that when you combine them, they ignite even if there is no oxygen present. So clearly, if you're going to go into an environment where there is a distinct lack of oxygen, that is important.
Mm-hmm.
So, they use nitrogen to help pump that fuel through, and also helium. Pressurized helium is actually used to move the fuel through the system. Nitrogen is used to help clear it out once you're done doing your maneuvers, because you don't want any fuel sitting in those fuel lines. Because that could be a problem the next time you need to use them. So, then there's a whole section about what the orbital maneuvering system can do. It can produce up to 6,000 pounds of thrust. And can accelerate the shuttle by 2 feet per second per second. Remember, acceleration is a change in velocity.
Yes. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did find this one interesting fact. The shuttle can go from 0 to 17,400 miles per hour in 8.5 minutes.
Just slightly faster than a Hummer.
And 9 times the speed of a rifle bullet.
Yeah, so don't... Never mind. yes.
Yes.
Why don't we, I have an interesting, kind of breakdown of what a launch sequence is like for, leading up to, well, half a minute before the shuttle actually launches.
Yeah. Okay.
So half a minute before the shuttle launches, actually T-minus 31 seconds, meaning that in 31 seconds, you're going to have launch, assuming that everything is copacetic.
Yes. That they're go.
Yeah, that they are go for launch. So at 31 seconds to launch, the onboard computers take over the launch sequence. So the astronauts really are sitting back and waiting to make sure that they are going to launch. 6.6 seconds from launch, the shuttle's main engines ignite one at a time, and they ignite 0.12 seconds apart from each other.
I always love that part, watching the launch.
Yeah. And they build up to about, oh, a little bit over 90% of their maximum thrust at that point. Now, 3 seconds from launch, the shuttle main engines are in liftoff position. So they have been, they're all mounted on gimbals, right? So they can actually be directed. They're not stuck in a single direction. So they've been positioned and they are at the correct amount of thrust for launch.
I love that part too.
T minus 0 seconds. This is the actual launch part. That's when the solid rocket boosters are ignited. And of course, they produce the 71% of the thrust needed to get the orbiter, or actually the entire shuttle, off the launch pad. So that's the point where you've got enough thrust to counteract the weight of this vehicle and launch it into the air.
Yeah. It looks like there's a ton of smoke, but actually what comes out of the engines is mostly water vapor.
Yep. So 20 seconds after the launch, you've got the first maneuver where the shuttle will roll right, about a 180 degree roll and a adjustment of 78 degrees in pitch. A minute after launch, the shuttle engines are at their maximum throttle. Then 2 minutes after launch, your solid rocket boosters will separate from the orbiter and fuel tank at about, they're about 28 miles up or 45 kilometers up in the atmosphere at that point. Now, the main engines on the orbiter continue to fire at that time. Now, once the solid rocket boosters separate from the rest of the shuttle, they will deploy parachutes and will land in the ocean around 140 miles off the coast of Florida. That's about 225 kilometers. And then those will be recovered by ships and actually be reused after being processed, obviously. You can't just slap them back on the launch pad, clearly. 7.7 minutes after launch, the main engines are throttled down to keep acceleration below 3 Gs, because otherwise you may harm the integrity of the space shuttle itself. 8.5 minutes after launch, you shut the main engines down. 9 minutes after launch, the external tank separates from the orbiter, and the external tank actually will burn up upon reentry. The 10.5 minutes after launch, the orbital maneuvering system engines fire to get the shuttle, the orbiter, into a low orbit. And 45 minutes after launch, the orbital maneuvering system engines will fire again to place in a slightly higher circular orbit, which is about 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, or 400 kilometers.
Yep.
So there you go. That's the whole process of just getting the orbiter into that orbit around the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, once they're up there, they will deploy satellites. They will do science experiments. Sometimes they'll go for an extra vehicular activity.
Yeah, it's a spacewalk.
Yes. I love the NASA terms.
EVA is what then?
And yes. And then they'll try to, get everything ready, pack up, and it's time to head home.
Yep.
I know you wanted to talk about that. They have to, there are a lot of people in the mission control center that help the shuttle astronauts as they're going through their mission. They will help them position the shuttle in the correct direction to come home.
The right attitude. Yeah, exactly. And they also will monitor all the different systems aboard the shuttle, because there are tons of different systems on there, right? I mean, when I say tons, of course, I mean there are lots of them.
Yes.
So things like everything from what we would call life support systems. So stuff that not just distributes oxygen through the system, but oxygen at the right mixture. You know, it's not going to be pure oxygen. It has to be atmosphere that's comparable to the Earth's atmosphere. Also, there have to be scrubbers that will scrub carbon dioxide from the atmosphere so it doesn't get too stuffy, or eventually it would get to a point where you could not breathe. So the carbon dioxide scrubbers use a chemical reaction where it takes carbon dioxide from the system, combines it with another compound, and then you end up getting a kind of inert material and sometimes water as a result. And that way you don't have carbon dioxide build up in the cabin. And also you have to worry about maintaining heat. The heat inside the space shuttle would continue to get warmer and warmer. The electrical systems actually provide more than enough heat to keep the shuttle warm, despite the fact that you would think, oh, well, you know what? Space is probably pretty cold. Well, that's true, but the electrical systems on the shuttle generate enough heat where they actually have to figure out ways to manage that heat so it doesn't overheat. So they've got a lot of different systems for that, and both passive and active systems for managing heat. There are lots and lots of other ones that we could talk about, but really, if we want to talk about the reentry system or the reentry process. That's also a very delicate procedure. Obviously, launching is going to be a pretty delicate thing as well. You're talking about lots and lots of very reactive agents in the launch process. Well, mm-hmm. coming back down is also pretty tricky. So here's the process that goes through a reentry. They close the cargo bay doors. That's yes. clearly very important.
Yes.
And most of the time when the orbiter is flying around the – or in orbit around the Earth, in relation to us, it would look like they are upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Like the top of the space shuttle would be facing the surface of the planet.
Right.
So they will actually use their thrusters to turn the orbiter. And they don't turn it so it faces directly like it's going to come down nose first. It actually – they face it tail first in order to start firing the OMS, the orbital maneuvering system engines, mm-hmm. to slow the orbiter down.
Right.
So they're actually, you know, they're using it to fire in the opposite direction of their orbit to slow down the orbiter. And it takes about 25 minutes from the first time they start firing those engines to the point where they reach the upper atmosphere. And at that, during that 25 minutes, they use their thrusters in order to turn the orbiter over again so that the bottom of the orbiter will face the atmosphere. And, they're moving again where it's nose first as opposed to tail first at that point. And then they will burn all the leftover fuel from their forward thruster system mm-hmm. as a safety precaution, because of course it's going to heat up quite a bit. So they don't want any fuel in that area of the orbiter before they start to really gain lots of heat. Now, this is where we talked about the idea of friction generating the heat. That's not right. exactly true.
Right.
What's happening is pressure. When the orbiter comes in at the into the atmosphere, it's compressing the air below it.
Right.
And that compression is what's generating that heat. So you may have heard that the friction is what causes the heat. Everyone's heard it. I mean,
yeah.
The Smithsonian reports it as friction. It's not friction. It's actually compression that's generating the heat. Now, there is friction playing a role. It is not that there's no friction, because if there were no friction, then the shuttle would just slide through the atmosphere like it was nothing. It's not... You know, not a non-factor. It's just that the major contributor to heat is the compression of the atmosphere as the shuttle re-enters the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So then it starts to come into the atmosphere. It's generating tons of heat through this compression. Again, not literally tons. I always get mail whenever I use the word tons.
Yeah.
To just say a lot. And it tries to distribute there's heat distribution methods that are mostly used through things like the reinforced carbon, which is RCC, which is on the wing surfaces, the underside of the shuttle. There's some high temperature insulation tiles on the upper forward fuselage and around the windows, things like that. That's what's used to absorb that heat. Once it's re-entered the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Now's the time where we talk about the whole flying element here.
Uh-huh.
So the shuttle has these swept back delta wings. That's the name of the design for right. the shuttle's wings.
Uh-huh.
And it can generate a lot of lift with a small surface area of wing space because of that design.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially flying under computer control at this point.
Yeah.
The astronauts are not guiding the shuttle, the orbiter, as it's coming in at this moment. And it starts to have to make these long S-shaped flight patterns. And the reason for that is to continually decelerate the orbiter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to slow it down. You can't just come in for a landing straight away, or else you'd need you'd have to go a much further distance in order to do it. So the S shape kind of helps the shuttle slow down. So it's mm-hmm. banking back and forth. And around about 140 miles away from the landing site, You've got the radio beacon from the runway, which is called the Tactical Air Navigation System. That gets picked up by the shuttle. And about 25 miles out from the landing site, that's when the computers hand over control to the shuttle's commander. So at that point, the shuttle does come under human control. And the commander actually flies the shuttle down and has to make a long, curved entry toward the landing strip and sets down the shuttle. Now, this whole time when the shuttle's coming down, it's coming down in a much steeper approach than what you would experience on your typical commercial air flight.
Right.
So, yeah, this would really freak me out if I were on a normal flight and arrived at this kind of steep grade. But at that point, the orbiter, once it's around, 2,000 feet above the ground, that's when the commander will lift the nose to slow the rate of descent.
Mm-hmm.
And, the pilot will deploy the landing gear. And that's when the orbiter touches down. They throw on the brakes, the vertical tail opens up, parachutes deployed, and that all helps to slow and eventually stop the orbiter.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you still have to wait a while.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have people just run up to the orbiter at that point. For one thing, it's still quite warm.
Yeah. You know, actually, I wanted to clarify because I had always been told, again, this is sort of a misnomer about the foam tiles. They're not really made of foam. I wanted to do a little bit of clarification that they're actually made of a silica fiber, basically sand mixed with some ceramic. And, you know, there is some air in there, which is why I think people describe it as being foam. There are pockets of air based on the way they're made.
Yep.
But they're not, it's not actually foam like you would see. You know, a styrofoam or some kind of plastic foam. So, just to clear that up before anybody writes in, I do know the difference in that.
Right.
But,
right.
They're actually a couple different kinds, but they do store heat. And, you know, anytime you've put something down on a ceramic tile, like, you know, a hot plate, when you have, one of those tiled tables and you lift it up, you know that the tiles are still holding heat in. And that's what's going on with the shuttle. You can't just, you know, wheel it up to the gate. Besides, usually when I get in, there's not a gate ready and you have to sit there.
Yeah. And there's also some, you know, the fuels that the shuttle burns also can generate some pretty nasty, gases that need to redistribute. Chris is giving me a funny look because he's, he's thinking I'm going to make a fart joke. I am not. No, there are noxious gases that are generated by the burning of this fuel. Stop laughing, you little 2-year-old. And then but you have to give it time for those to dissipate.
Yes.
And also for the shuttle to cool down, the orbiter to cool down. Once that happens, it takes probably about, 20 to 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They'll start powering down the systems, and then that's when the crew will exit the shuttle to great acclaim.
Yes.
And so that's kind of a beginning to end look at a basic overview of a space shuttle mission. Now, there are so many more elements we could go into. I mean, this episode's already gone 45 minutes, and we barely touched on even half of what we could have talked about. In fact, we probably could have done an entire episode just about a launch.
Yes.
But we wanted to give you more of a overview of the space shuttle itself. If you want to learn more, like I said, the How Stuff Works article is fantastic, but also NASA has I'm not going to use tons again. Lots of resources.
Yes.
There's
a
lot of information about the space shuttle on their site.
There are some interesting facts, and I mean, just as in factoids and little things that are just interesting to people who are curious, also some extremely technical documents too. So no matter how interested you are, assuming you're interested somewhat, there will be something. Just a couple notes. The launch date is planned for July 8th, 2011. For Space Shuttle Atlantis on STS-135, which is the last planned space shuttle mission. They are supposed to be launching at 11:26 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, as of the time we're recording this, from Kennedy Space Center at Pad 39A. They're scheduled to land on July 20th at 7:06 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time at Kennedy Space Center. And their primary payload is the Raffaello Multipurpose Logistics Module, whatever that is. So Godspeed to the shuttle astronauts on this final mission.
I know
we are going to be very sad to see the program end, but
I'll be
something else.
I'll be watching the launch live, I'm sure. On the computer. I actually had a chance to maybe get a standby position for the tweet up, but sadly I am not able to take advantage of it because I used up all my vacation recently.
Well, hopefully Megan and some of the others who are going to the tweet up will keep us up to date on what's going on.
Certainly. I sure hope so.
Enjoy that.
That's going to wrap up this discussion of the space shuttle, and we will be tackling other space-related topics in the near future. Actually, for Chris and I, we'll be tackling it in about 30 seconds, but you'll be hearing it later on. Anyway, we're going to talk about more elements about the space program. If you have anything specific you would like us to talk about, whether it's the space program or anything else, let us know. You can let us know on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuff, HSW, or you can send us an email. That address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.